revering Buddhas and ancestors, we're one Buddha and one ancestor. Thus we take up these old stories of the Buddhas and ancestors. Even if we can't fully understand them, still we open our hearts to a spirit of reverence for these ancients who practiced the way so diligently so that we could be here today. Continuing with the valley sounds, mountain colors, Dogen's celebration of non-sentient beings teaching Dharma. We've come to the story on near the bottom of page 2. Of Langya, Huizhui, great master Guangzhou, was a Dharma descendant of Nanyue. Once Zhi Xuan, a lecturer on the scriptures, and apparently he was particularly known for his lectures on the Sharangama Sutra, quoted the Sharangama Sutra, saying, quote of a question asker in the sutra, asking the Buddha. So he asks teacher Langya in that same way, if originally unconditioned, or again, literally, it's pure, originally pure, how do mountains, rivers, and the great earth suddenly emerge? Or we could say, if all is originally fundamental, original purity, how do mountains, rivers, and the great earth suddenly arise? How are those things of the world suddenly born from this original empty purity? And Langya responds, if originally unconditioned, pure, how do mountains, rivers, and the great earth suddenly emerge? And as we looked through yesterday, this is also case number 100, the last story in the Book of Serenity, the Shoyoroku. So here's the sutra, that story that this comes from, the Sharangama Sutra, the heroic stride, heroic march sutra. The Buddha's disciple Purna Maitreyani Putra, one of the arhats, the worthy ones who in the early teachings has realized the fruit of ending outflows, we call it. The outflow of the basic ignorance in an independent self. And not just glimpsed that, but has fully integrated that into their being. So they are dwelling in irreversible nirvana. These are the arhats, the great celebrated saints of the early Buddhist teachings. So Purna Maitreyani Putra arose from his seat in the midst of the great assembly, uncovered his right shoulder, knelt on his right knee, put his palms together respectfully, and said to the Buddha, "The most virtuous and awe-inspiring world-honored one has, for the sake of living beings, expounded the primary truth of the Tathagata, the Thus Come One, with remarkable eloquence." And the world-honored one often points out that I am among the best of speakers of Dharma, but now when I hear the Buddha's wonderful and subtle expression of Dharma, I am like a deaf person who at a distance of more than 100 paces tries to hear a mosquito, which in fact cannot be seen, let alone heard. So, I'm an arhat, I'm a completely realized one, according to this, to the smaller vehicle. But now when I hear these great vehicle teachings, I feel like actually listening, trying to listen to a mosquito at 100 yards away, and I'm like a deaf person trying to hear the mosquito's dharma from 100 paces away. So I'm suddenly like, feel like this dharma is way beyond me. So this is one of these Mahayana stories that this is like much more subtle and profound than what the arhats have realized. We in the assembly have reached the level of no outflows. In other words, we're arhats. Yet although we have no outflows, we still have doubts about the dharma we have now heard the Tathagata speak, you know, prior to this in the sutra. World honored one, if all the sense organs, sense objects, body and mind, the skandhas or aggregates, places and realms in all the world are the Tathagata Garbha, at the treasury of the Thus Come One, originally pure, then why do all conditioned appearances such as mountains, rivers, and the great earth suddenly arise? So that's the quote that is brought up in this Zen koan, straight out of the sutra. A little bit elaborated here. It says, if all the, he's talking about the whole phenomenal world, you could say from a kind of mind only point of view, the whole world is sense organs, including mind organ, sense objects, colors, sounds, and smells, and so on, and mental objects, body and mind, places and realms. This is the what we call the world, actually. If all of those aspects of the world are the Tathagata Garbha, originally pure Buddha awareness, we could say, why then do all these conditioned appearances, such as mountains, rivers, and the great earth, suddenly appear or arise? And then he asks some more questions, and the Buddha says, Purna, you have asked why in fundamental purity the mountains, rivers, and the great earth suddenly arise. Or, if all is originally pure, how do mountains, rivers, and the great earth suddenly arise? So, he just repeats back, kind of like in the story. Maybe the this sutra lecture says, in originally pure, how do mountains, rivers, and the great earth suddenly arise? And Long Ya says, originally pure, how do mountains, rivers, and the great earth suddenly arise? But that's the end. Now, the Buddha is going to go on to say a lot of things here, that this would be an interesting sutra for sure to look into at some point. There's a bunch of these Tathagatagarbha Buddha nature teachings throughout this Sharangama Sutra. So Purna, in summary, after all this complicated explanation of how different kinds of birth take place and so on, the Buddha says that these three kinds of, or all kinds of confusion and upside down understanding come from the light which is added to enlightenment. So he mentions this a lot. The Buddha is saying the problem with sentient beings is there's this original enlightenment, and then people add light to it, and it doesn't need more light. It's like adding the light is the light is where we see differentiated objects and so on. So adding the light where we can distinguish this is enlightenment and that's not enlightenment, these kinds of things are like adding light to enlightenment. All these kinds of upside down understandings come from the light which is added to enlightenment. With this false enlightening of the knowing nature, subjective awareness gives rise to objective appearances. So, again and again, this seems to be the basic problem. Subjective awareness gives rise to objective appearances, and we have this dualistic split of subject and object. We have ourselves and the world. We have mind or consciousness and an objective world that's experienced by consciousness. And that split is the origin of the great mass of suffering. So both the subjective awareness and the objective appearances are born of false views, and from this falseness, the mountains, rivers, great earth, and all conditioned appearances unfold themselves in a succession that recurs in endless cycles. So from this confusion of separation between subject and object, the great earth, mountains and rivers, unfold and appear and arise in succession and endless cycles. So purity is originally so, but then we add some extra light to that brightness. It's perfectly complete, it doesn't, with nothing lacking and nothing extra, but beings add a little extra light to it, and then it's kind of funny image, right? But that's how it's presented. A little extra light, it's too much, and then dualistic appearances arise as the world of mountains and rivers. That's the basic story. And there's a little more that Purna asks. If this wonderful enlightenment, this basic, miraculous, enlightened brightness, the original purity, which is neither greater than nor less than the mind of the Tathagata, in other words, this Tathagata heart, this Tathagata garbha, this Buddha nature, is not greater than or less than the mind of the Buddha. No difference at all. If this enlightenment abruptly brings forth the mountains, rivers, and the great earth, and all conditioned appearances. So this was, we had this little discussion yesterday about, well, is it like the Dharmakaya that gives rise to the appearance, mountains and rivers? And I was saying, well, the Dharmakaya is like the full fruition, the Buddha's full fruition of Buddha's Dharma body. And then I proposed that we could say that the Tathagata Garbha, this kind of heart or womb, heart of the Tathagata, of the Buddha, that the Buddha nature that's still mixed with the dualistic appearances, that Tathagata Garbha can give rise to the world. And afterwards I thought, is that really right? That would be nice to find a reference, a scriptural reference for that. And I feel like this is actually saying that. Again, it's if this wonderful enlightenment, basic miraculous brightness, that's not greater than or less than the mind of the Tathagata, so I would understand that as the Tathagata Garbha, this bright, luminous, empty Buddha nature, that's the same as the mind of the Tathagata, that abruptly brings forth mountains, rivers, and great earth. So it sounds like that's what's being said, that basic, miraculous, empty, bright mind brings forth all these appearances of mountains, rivers, and earth. But now that the Tathagata has attained wonderful, empty, bright enlightenment, complete the Dharmakaya, you could say, will the mountains, rivers, the great earth, and all conditioned habitual outflows arise again? Like for you, Buddha, now that you've come to full fruition of Buddhahood, will these mountains, rivers, and great earth arise again? And after some discussion, the Buddha says, why do you ask if this wonderful, enlightened, bright emptiness can once again give rise to mountains, rivers, and the great earth? After understanding, after completely manifesting that bright, empty Tathagata heart as the Buddha, as the Dharma body of the Buddha. And the Buddha says, it's like a piece of ore containing gold and a mixture of other metals. Once the pure gold is extracted, it will not become ore again. It's like wood that's been burned to ashes. It will not become wood again. The Bodhi and Nirvana of all Buddhas and Tathagatas are the same way. Which I think is implying that once this Buddhahood is fully manifested, it doesn't regress, right? It doesn't go back and produce these mountains, waters, and earth again, actually. So it's more like that the Tathagata Garbha, the Tathagata heart that lives as sentient beings, that's what's producing the mountains, rivers, and earth, but the Dharmakaya doesn't actually produce them anymore. And it doesn't say that explicitly here. But we also do have stories of that the Dharmakaya, the Buddha's full fruitional body, can manifest in response to beings, like the moon reflected in water. Especially in the Zen tradition, that's emphasized. The Dharmakaya can manifest as even like things like trees and maybe rocks and things like this. But it's not that all trees and rocks are the Dharmakaya. That's going too far. It's just the Dharmakaya can manifest as certain things in order to liberate beings. So maybe that night on Lushan, when that poet Sudongpo heard the sound of the valley streams as the Buddha's long broad tongue, maybe this was the Buddha's Dharma body manifesting as a mountain stream to wake up that poet. We'll never know. Yes.
It sounds very theistic to me when it's that concept that the Dharma in a particular awareness in response to a particular sentient being. You know what I mean? It's like God.
It does sound that way, yeah. Yeah, I think as sentient beings, we hear it like, oh, here comes the Dharmakaya, like deciding, even like deciding to, like, I think I'll be a, look at this person in the mountains, I'll move into the valley stream now and start singing Dharma verses. So that's how we think of it.
In order to awaken this particular.
Yeah, in order to awaken this particular being. So this, you know, how the Dharmakaya works is, you know, this incredibly profound topic, which is quite wonderfully talked about in the Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra in a pretty thorough way. It seems, my understanding is that the way the Dharmakaya responds to beings, like the moon reflected in water, and by the way, that story, you might know that it's in the Book of Serenity. How does the Dharmakaya respond to beings like the moon reflected in the water? And the response is, it's like a donkey looking at a well. So that particular koan is about the response of the Dharma body of Buddha from kind of Zen perspective, from a more kind of traditional Indian perspective. In the Mahayana, it's like the way that the Dharmakaya doesn't have like an intention like a sentient being has. It's like it's no longer, there's no traces of dualistic mind. In fact, right, the whole storehouse consciousness, the whole alaya vijnana, the container of all these experiences, has been transformed, right? It's got the transformation of the basis. We say is that our everything we've ever experienced that maintains the continuity of like a person that is gone. It's gone. It's like transformation means it's not exactly like it becomes some other thing, but it. Is like used up. It's the storehouse of all the obscurations that's mixed in again, like this image of mud and water mixed together. So it's like the sediment, all these infinite number of sediment particles that we call alaya vijnana in this story have like settled out completely and just evaporated. So alaya vijnana is gone, the sediment's gone, and now there's just clear water. And to us, that's like inconceivable, you know. We can't, anything we can imagine about what that's like at that point is, has nothing to do with it, because it's beyond all imaginations. But it's not nothing. It's, we call it like Buddha mind, or the Dharma body of Buddha, the Dharmakaya. And then, but that can manifest, we say, well, how could it manifest if it has no more intentions? Intentions are just a human construct. And it's like this very strange thing, according to these stories, like it manifests due to the intentions of all sentient beings. Like, almost like we could say the Dharma body is now, it's like in total intimate communion with all sentient beings that have intentions. So it no longer decides anything on its own. It's not a thing, but it can manifest as, for example, the main one we know of is the Nirmanakaya, like Shakyamuni Buddha. Nirmanakaya Buddha is like was this person in 528 BC India. A certain time and place, there was this human being that we say is a manifestation body, you know, of the Dharma body. It's not like they're really separate, but we say a transformation body. Nirmana is like transformation or manifestation body. And again, it sounds kind of theistic. It sounds like the Father and the Son, you know, that the inconceivable source manifests as this human being. So the Mahayana compared to earlier Theravada teachings does start to play with expressions that get closer to what we might call theistic, actually. But it's not really like it's something. The Dharmakaya is not actually an entity or locatable, or even like, you know, it's not like there's different Dharmakayas of different Buddhas like floating around in the sky and different ones come down and help in these different ways. The way that it responds is just inconceivable. The response, you could say, is inconceivable and and beyond all intentions. Yes.
Is the are these seeds in the Alaya Vijnana settling out through practice? Is that what the transformation at the base is?
Yeah.
Is it through practice?
Yeah, practice. All kinds of practices of the paramitas of more and more, you know, like generosity, but more and more in the direction of transcendent generosity, meaning like without any thought of someone being generous to someone else. You know. But actually those kind of practices and, you know, ethical conduct without any ideas of being that way, and patience and enthusiasm and meditative concentration without any separation into the one doing those practices and the world that those practices are done to. So those are the great practices. And of course, Prajnaparamita is maybe the main practice.
Well, as Chris mentioned yesterday about, you know, watering, I mean, this image of watering these seeds, is it through practice we kind of gain awareness of this, you know, what Westerners call the unconscious or the alaya, or the seeds, and they see sort of the karmic power that these seeds have, whether they're watered or not?
I would say it's not so much a matter of like seeing the seeds and how they work. I mean, it is partly that. That's why we have these teachings about how Alaya works. But it's more like, even if you never heard about the storehouse consciousness, according to these stories about it, you don't need to even know how it works so much. You just need to do the practices of like the paramitas and so on. And particularly, we'd say the wisdom, the Prajnaparamita that is dropping away or seeing through dualistic constructs and mental constructions of worlds. So the Alaya story is a nice story to kind of like contain these, you know, to show, kind of show how the process works. But it's not so much like we start seeing into Alaya, because it is we could call it the unconscious, and we don't ever need to become conscious of it. I don't think it's possible to become conscious of all the stuff that's in there. It seems to me more that it's like through not reifying the objective world, for example, that is changing the Alaya, or that's settling down the sediment, or dissolving. Maybe we say like the sediment actually dissolves into the water. It's like, probably there's some elements that do that, right? Where it's like, I don't know enough chemistry. You know, maybe there's something that actually mixes with the water so completely. It's a kind of nicer image, because it's not like it's been sitting at the bottom. Like it's a sludge forever.
Emulsion, they call it.
Emulsion. Okay. Emulsion.
When the molecules, you know, like oil.
Uh-huh.
Does that bind the molecules?
Yeah, it binds with the molecules, yeah.
Body emulsion. Burning
up seeds of karma.
Mm.
Is that like when you talk about evaporating?
Mm.
Would that be the same thing as that image of burning up?
Yeah. What is that? What is actually burning up karma? It's kind of like, maybe we talk about burning up past karma as like karma is the intentional activities that create some effects, and now we're having a painful effect, karmic effect is now arising from a past karmic action. And we could say that like to really just embrace the effect means like the pain that's arising in the moment due to a past action, and not resisting that, letting it actually just fully burn, and without trying to push it under into another side of the field where it will just smolder for a long time and maybe come back and burn up later. Maybe that's what we mean by burning up karma, letting it fully, let the effect be fully received.
Without creating new.
I kind of say something harsh to somebody from a kind of self-protective place, and then they come back and say like, "You jerk!" They respond, and then I feel, and then I receive that effect, and it's painful now, and I see how the effect that came back to me actually was created by my karmic action of saying something to them. And instead of saying, what am I going to say back to them next? How can we keep this thing going? And because it's not fair, I'm not going to lose this argument. So what can I call them next time I see them? That would just, you know, it doesn't burn up the effects. It plants more seeds. So instead of just, oh, I feel the pain and I see how it works, that acting from a place of separate self is now resulting in a painful situation, and I receive it fully, I'm just open to it, I breathe it, and I embrace it as the workings of the universe. That might burn up, or start to burn up, that particular seed. As we can see, this is a big project.
well, tell us when we're going astray here. This fascicle did bring it up.
Yeah. And, in fact, the fascicle.
And I just find myself, you know, because I don't know so much, I don't know whether I'm staying on track or whether I'm just, going on and on.
You mean about this fascicle?
My mind is just sort of spinning like, yes, how do I tie in karma? Is karma part of this whole Dharmakaya alive schema? Or is that like another school.
Yeah. And
we're just trying to like nirvana. Mm. Are we just trying to put all the schools that we know to see if they, meld together because we've already got kind of ideas of what nirvana is, the burning up and karma.
Well, that's a good point.
When we're just kind of tripping.
Yeah, it's tricky because, in a way, everything is related. So, but karma, when we're talking about alaya vijnana, karma is a really big aspect of it. So I think that's a good part to bring up. Whether alaya vijnana and karma have anything to do with this right now where we are in the fascicle is maybe another question. But as it goes on, it's going to talk about, although our past evil karma has greatly accumulated, being the cause and condition of obstacles in practicing the way, we could say obstacles is the alaya vijnana, is this obstacle in realizing the dharma body. So it's related, but we're kind of like skipping ahead a little. Yes?
So in the alaya, there are seeds, and some of those seeds come up as karma we want to burn out. And some of those seeds are things that we water, like the paramitas, or that we can water by enacting. But before we started talking about the alaya, you talked about the alaya disappearing.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, like, because from a functional place, like in my life, I can say, like, when I go eat fast food, that's me watering the seeds of eating fast food. And, when I come and sit zazen, it's me watering the seeds.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in my mind, it's pretty dualistic. It's like bad and good.
Uh-huh.
But you were talking about getting rid of the alaya or it dissolving.
Yeah.
And the water kind of just remaining.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm having mixed metaphors, in my head. Because if there's seed, if Dharmakaya is the water and everything else is the sediment.
Mm-hmm.
And the sediment is actually the alaya and the seeds. I'm just a little. I guess my question is, I know that to just take on, it, just to feel the effect of karma, that burnout, and then to water the seeds that I want to water, practice, study. What if you want the alaya to go away?
Well, as I say, it's a big project. So it may be that for many, many lifetimes, it may be a matter of just gradually reshaping alaya. It's not like suddenly it's going to it dissolves. It's like that's like the final step of from Buddhahood, actually, we'd say. Arhat. There's some things in Vasubandhu's 30 verses that you can check out about this topic, where it talks about alaya ceasing. I don't think it says in the Arhat. I think it talks about the seventh consciousness. But for the Buddha, for a Buddha, it's dissolved, dissolved or transformed. Again, transformed is not exactly it because it's not like it becomes something else. It's more like it's actually a lie is like an illusory thing. It's a storehouse of illusion, and it's like the illusion is when it's seen to be illusion, it's like it's not there. Like in the snake and the rope metaphor, when you see, you think it's a snake, and you look closer, and oh, it's just a rope. It's like the snake's is a lie, we could say. So did the snake transform into a rope? No, not really. Did the snake dissolve? No, not really either, right? It's more like a lie is seen to be, like, not the case. This is all just a vast story to, which I think, it's nice to hear these stories because it shows the vast scope of the Mahayana and this practice. So we might think, yeah, we're Buddhas, right? We're like doing the thing. we're pretty much done. We just keep doing this practice, and this is it, right? That there is this story of like what's possible. Now maybe it's just made up, but there is this a story that's been agreed upon by many people through the centuries that it's possible to actually dissolve a sentient being and become a Buddha. And we don't actually know what that looks like, but like everything we've ever thought is kind of like obscured, you know, and to actually have the aspiration. And the whole point of this aspiration too is not just because it would be cool to dissolve a sentient being, but to benefit all beings, to actually benefit what we call sentient beings, with great, great compassion. Yes, did you have a question?
I guess now I have two questions. What's it called, the Alaya?
Alaya is the storehouse.
When you say storehouse, do you mean the collective, all of it? Or do you mean like a space where it's all held? Like, what exactly is the Alaya?
Yeah.
Is that like physical manifestation or thought manifestation?
It's not physical. It has no location. And it's not to say that it's a container or storehouse or receptacle or different translations of Alaya is not quite right, because it's not like the edges, it's not like a bucket that holds all the stuff. It's not really the container, it's more just the collection of all experiences we've ever had, which of course has no physical location, right? But you can, in this story, it's maybe kind of metaphor too. Is there really an Alaya? Well, it's a way of talking about like we can talk about the collection of all the experiences we've ever had. And sometimes we think of that as like ourself or like our
consciousness.
But it's, except that it's like, it's not just like all of our experiences together. It's kind of individual. In the sense that, at least conventionally speaking, all living beings have their own storehouse consciousness. So that's why, when you're watering the seeds, you're not watering somebody else's seeds, right? Or when you're practicing, it doesn't affect the other person. I mean, it does a little, but and that's why I put in quotes your own, because in fact, all the Alayas are totally interpenetrating and dependently arising together, all being. We could say Alaya is the sentient being, in a way. And are sentient beings like individual and separate? Well, kind of, conventionally speaking, we say that, but we're all interrelated and we affect each other.
So it's like it's both.
Yeah, but I think it's more important to look at how there's these individual streams, because this is how, like, according to the Buddhist story, beings are reborn, not just from like a collective whole, but there's individual karmic streams that lead to particular births as new sentient beings, not just randomly. I mean, in America, we don't like this kind of story so much. It seems too weird. We like to think that it's more like, well, we're just born out of like the whole universe, and we emerge back into the whole universe. That's much more palatable. But this story is more like, that's why the karmic activities we do now will affect future births, both an hour from now and tomorrow and the next day and after this life. And again, this is the classical story. So that's why this might be a very long project. It might take more than this lifetime, but as much as we can do through practice in this lifetime to evolve, it's a way to talk about it too, we're evolving the storehouse of all our experiences, or we could say the collection, maybe that's better than storehouse, just the collection of all our experiences. It's not like in a bucket or a bubble or something, but it's just the sum total of everything, and we're evolving the sum total of everything every time we practice, and every time we do something harmful, we're also evolving it in a different kind of way.
So it's kind of like this from
Yeah, stream of consciousness or stream of unconsciousness, we could even say. Well, we can't see, like, all the experiences we've ever had, right? We can't just say, right, I mean, maybe you might have had this experience where you see your whole life. In a moment, and Buddha had that kind of thing sometimes, but generally it's like, we only they say, like, our conscious mind's like the tip of the iceberg, right? We're only accessing these little bits. Even when we try, let me just try to remember when we were 5 years old, we might come up with one memory, but the storehouse or the collection of all experiences would include every moment's memory from when we were 5 years old. Like, we can't, that's unconscious, right? We can't access all that stuff. There's certain practices we can do, like hypnotism and stuff, right? To start to access stuff that we think is long gone or we think we've long forgotten, which is a kind of proof, you could say, of a liar. That there's, this stuff is in there and it is, sometimes it bubbles up, but most of it's unconscious. And I don't think that Buddhas become conscious of it, because by the time the Buddhas, it's gone. And then, you know, we don't need to like pull out the, like, you know, in 10 trillion experiences and like line them all up and look at them. We never need to do that. We just need to because they're all, the thing is too, that they're all illusory. They're all distorted by, like, we think that they actually happened. That's part of their thing. It's the storehouse of the illusion that we've had a life, that we've had all these experiences, which truly, from an ultimate perspective, we've never had any experiences, actually. This is getting weird now, right? But that's what you could say is the dissolving it, is the full realization that we've never had any experiences. That it's just like, it's like a grand illusion. Like the movie of our life comes to an end. And it's like, that was nice, now it's done. And the little, like, end of the film is spinning around the wheel, right? And the screen is just light. The images are all gone, but there's still that light. This is new, getting pretty off the fascicle, but
I was thinking a way to explain the I-thou dichotomy, whatever, is to see affinities and a resonance. Like, this is all Dharmakaya, this is all luminosity right here. But let's say we see the ocean, Pacific Ocean of Peace, and some people look at it and see this massive waves coming at them, and this is their life experience. And others see the ocean of peace. It's fast. It's stable and certain. And then we go to the mountains, and some people see precipices, and others see lofty heights and vast views. And because of resonance, and the resonances are developed by habituation, by habits. You meditate on the more subtle things and get that luminous perspective. Seeing the Dharmakaya rather than the conventional view. So we have to, through habits and planting seeds, then we get the Dharmakaya view. And so all these, then we have stack up impressions against and into the storehouse consciousness. And the subtle view, I think what's happening, every action we do, it comes up against basic nature, Dharmakaya. And whatever contact it makes is going to get repercussions. So if you attack Dharmakaya, you get a repercussion. If you move into Dharmakaya, you get a repercussion. So that's why I think. So we plant the little seeds, and they're very subtle. It's going to be a very dramatic action out here, but then subtle thoughts, and even more subtle motivating thoughts. Whatever. So that's what that contact is made. So when we die, all this collects, and when we're born, it all starts unfolding based upon habits and affinities.
And you can say watching that whole process is a really important part of the practice too, right?
I think
being aware of it.
You were saying something about that. You know, when our own life experience disappears, it's because now our life experience is then the Dharmakaya. You know, when we have exhausted all personal
attachments to self or something. Conceive back to the karmic trends of any individual. All that information is accessible to a Buddha, even if the future man is in it. But then, so we can look at our life, and I think we see, then when we look at our own life, maybe we might not be cognizant of every thought and every previous action we did, but we can see the highlight points when I was 12, this in this train or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I think the scope gets larger and larger and larger, and we get more and more toward the Buddha.
Yeah.
Approaching it from a different angle rather than the conventional approach.
Let's, before we do more questions, how about we go on a little bit? Do you have some?
Yeah, I had a question about the Mountain Dew.
She could segue us back.
Okay.
I don't know if it is a segue. Well, I just said that you can say that it is not, but getting back to the mountains and suddenly emerging from what is originally. Condition. My question, I'm just going to ask you to talk a little bit then about greed, hate, and delusion. If beginningless, how did they emerge from what is originally?
Well, the story here is like they're the same as mountains, rivers, and earth. And we could talk about it like there was a first just dualistic impulse at some point. We'll say consciousness, actually. The first arising of consciousness was like the first division of like there's now a living being experiencing a world. So as soon as, you know, from an evolutionary point of view, we could say as soon as consciousness arose, that was the seed of greed, hate, and delusion. It all just flowered from there. It got more and more divided, you know. First it's just me and a world, amazing. We're conscious of a world, and it's like, but like, can we have a little bit more of this kind of world, a little bit less of that kind of world? And there's greed, hate, and delusion. That's true. Beginning, well, so that's why I've been reflecting recently how Darwin's theory of evolution might not completely accord with Buddha Dharma, because it says that at some point consciousness arose on an unconscious world. But from a Buddhist perspective, the world, it's the opposite. Instead of there's the world and then consciousness arises, it's the opposite, right? It's like first there's consciousness and then a world arises from that. And it's inconceivable. To say beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, beginningless mind and consciousness, we'll never know, right? It's inconceivable how it started. We're just here now and trying to work with it. Let me just go on now a little bit. So we'll leave the sutra here for now. So the story again was, now this informed by that whole discussion, This scholar asks, if originally pure, how do mountains, rivers, and great earth suddenly emerge? And the Zen teacher's response is, if originally pure, how do mountains, rivers, and the great earth suddenly emerge? Repeating back his question, maybe he even like mimicked his tone of voice to emphasize that very question is what gives rise to mountains, rivers, and earth. He could have even said, like, you just created mountains, rivers, and earth right then, right? So there it is. That's a kind of a pithy Zen response to this long discussion about the Sharangama Sutra and Alaya and the Dharmakaya and so on. this dilemma, like you're hanging from a tree by your mouth and somebody asks you, why Bodhidharma came from the West, and you're like, oh, this is really stuck. It's like, well, we just made ourselves stuck, right? Or that teacher, by setting up the thing, you're hanging from a branch, you made us hanging from a branch, right? We didn't feel stuck until he asked the question. So it's like, as soon as we like bring forth anything, there is the world. So Dogen says, now we know. The mountains, rivers, and great earth, which are originally unconditioned, should not be mistaken for mountains, rivers, and great earth. This is classic Dogen, right? And we could say, we could add a little parentheses in here, like the pure, originally unconditioned mountains, rivers, and earth should not be mistaken for our ideas about mountains, rivers, and earth. I mean, he's kind of saying that the mountains, rivers, and earth themselves are originally unconditioned. They shouldn't be mistaken for the conditioned mountains, rivers, and earth that we normally experience as mountains, rivers, and earth. The Sutra master had never heard this, so he did not understand mountains, rivers, and the great earth as just mountains, rivers, and the great earth. That's Dogen's just. When mountains, rivers, and earth are just mountains, rivers, and earth, then they're not the conditioned mountains, rivers, and earth. So when sitting is just sitting, then it's free from all the ideas of sitting. Know that without mountain colors and valley sounds, Shakyamuni Buddha's taking up the flower and Huayka's attaining the marrow would not have taken place. So this realm of inconceivable dependent arising, that the mountains and rivers that are incessantly teaching Dharma are working together totally harmoniously with our original teacher Shakyamuni Buddha holding up the flower on Vulture Peak. I think most of you know the story, the first Zen transmission. The flower sermon. Holds up a flower and Mahakashyapa smiles. Everyone else is like, huh? And he says, Mahakashyapa, you have the treasury of the true Dharma eye. And he took up, and it's maybe also that particular story is chosen because he took up a flower, right? It's just another natural element of the world that the Zen Dharma transmission started with just seeing a flower, like a peach blossom. And Huayka's attaining the marrow is that story of when Huayka's Bodhidharma's disciple, and Bodhidharma said to his four students, each of you express your understanding, and they each said a wonderful Dharma verse. And to each one of them, Bodhidharma said, you retain my skin, you retain my flesh, you retain my bones. And Huayka, the last one, express your understanding. And he just stood there. And Bodhidharma said, you retain my marrow. So just seeing a flower, just no response with words, the Dharma is carried on. Because of the power of valley sounds, literally it's the merit and virtue of valley sounds and mountain colors, the great earth and sentient beings simultaneously attain the way. So we've heard that's a classic Zen version of the Buddha's enlightenment too. At Buddha's awakening, he said, I simultaneously with the great earth and all beings attain the way. So now from this long mind only kind of discussion, and we have a different, like a deeper or more full take on what that means, right? I attain the way simultaneously with all beings in the great earth. If this is all mind, there's no separation. It's not like some beings are outside of it or some are inside of it. Everything goes together. Because of this merit and virtue of the valley sounds and mountain colors, there are also countless Buddhas who are enlightened upon seeing the morning star. Again, just seeing a star, a natural phenomena, but seeing the star, this is where, as I said, it's really hard for me to see those stars as not separate from mind. to not think that they're out there far, far away. But what did the Buddha see when he saw that star and countless Buddhas? Such skin bags are earlier sages whose aspiration for seeking Dharma was profound. Skin bags is that Zen phrase for people. Bags of skin. But he's praising these ancient sages are called skin bags. And we could say that this is a transition now in this essay towards human endeavor in the way. So these were skin bags. These weren't like ethereal Dharmakaya Buddhas. These were like skin bags filled with organs and flowing blood and life, human sentient beings as we know and love them, whose aspiration for seeking Dharma was profound. People today should be inspired by predecessors like these. Authentic study, free of concern for fame and gain, should be based on such aspiration. So now we're moving into, we've been celebrating the wonders of nature for a couple days, and now it's kind of like inspired, hopefully inspired by the purity of nature and mind. Now Dogen's going to say, so now let's get to work. Let's like start looking at our practice and start acknowledging our greed, hate, and delusion, confessing and repenting and seeing all the obscurations that block this pure vision. So first, the topic brought up is concern for fame and gain, which is going to keep getting woven through here. Dogen brings up a lot that, you know, there's like sometimes listed five desires in this world. And the first three are like a basic desires for like sex, food, and sleep. You know, we can't get around too much. We can work with these things, the basic human desires that can cause a lot of suffering, as we know. So we have to check out our relationship with them very carefully. But then the other two are fame and profit, name and gain. It's a nice. Sometimes I've tried to kind of like. So it's this classic Buddhist list, right? Five desires. And to try to put all other desires into those five and to subcategorize them. I've tried doing that before and seeing, oh yeah, this is actually an aspect of one of these five. You know, it's a nice summary anyway of like our general tendencies. But those physical ones, Dogen doesn't hardly ever talks about these basic things. Like, you can work that stuff out. But let's look at fame and profit, name and gain, fame and gain, the more psychological issues. Fame or name or reputation and gain or profit or advantage. Fortune. So authentic study, free of concern for fame and gain, should be based on such aspiration. In this remote nation, Japan, in recent days, those who genuinely seek Buddha Dharma are rare. It's not that there are none, it's just that they're rare. Many people leave their households, they leave home, appearing to be free from worldly matters, but in fact they use the Buddha way to seek fame and gain. What a pity. How sad that they waste their time in unilluminated trades. It looks like the characters there are black karma. Unilluminated trades. I think it just means negative action. When will they break off and attain the way? if they meet a true teacher, how can they recognize the true dragon? And, or how do they, how can they love the true dragon, literally? Which is that story of, nice little Zen story that we hear, that Dogen quotes. We actually chanted this morning, right? Long accustomed to groping for the elephant, do not be suspicious of the true dragon. And it comes from that story of this old Chinese guy who collected toy dragons, model dragons of all different kinds and materials. And he really loved dragons. He had a big dragon collection in his, on his shelf at home. And one day there was like an actual real dragon flying around in the sky, and thought, wow, this guy collects dragons. Let's go visit him. He'll be so happy to see me. He's never seen a real one. So that dragon flew through his window, and the guy just passed out. He just couldn't deal with the real dragon, even though he loved carved dragons, toy dragons. So this Dogen's getting into his admonishing mode now, which we love. And to how to take this to heart, really, you know, we may feel like, well, I'm not as bad as these people he's talking to, but let's, you know, really check out ourselves. Particularly, he's talking to practitioners, right? That those who leave home appearing to be free from worldly matters, but in fact using the Buddha way to seek fame and gain. So, you know, being ordained as a priest, things like this, lay ordinations, are we seeking some recognition for ourselves? Or is it the expression, the classical expression is like, I want to let go of myself and everything, and I want to express that in the old way that the Buddha initiated these ways. So like, let's express it like that. Or is it like, it's cool that the Buddha had these expressions, and it's like, like a dharma, it's a dharma club, let's join it. So this is, yeah, this is Thomas Cleary, who can really like get into these. In his commentary here, he's very striking. I just thought I'd read his a kind of longer commentary on this little section now. He's commenting on all these paragraphs of this essay. He says, in old Japan, becoming a Buddhist monk was a way of rising socially, politically, and financially. Nowadays, it's still for many Buddhist clergy little more than a way of making a living. For most, in fact, it is a hereditary business into which they're born. So this is the case in Japan particularly. People are born into it, and it's actually very business-oriented in modern Japan. They say Zen is the funeral business. So that's how they make their income. They don't actually have retreats. Like, I mean, this is, this kind of thing that we're doing here is very, this would be like in a Buddhist monastery in Japan, you do things like this. And those tend to be not so, not really businesses. But even then, in the monasteries, the way the whole system's set up, as you know, some of you, in order to be the businessman priest, mostly men, there's some women, you have to get your credentials, you have to get your priest license to do funerals. So in order to do that, you have to go to the monastery, because there's still like, we really should go through this, it's nice that they honor that, you know, let's at least get a little taste for this original, like, Dogen's way of life. So that, you know, for maybe half a year or something, people will go So even the monasteries in Japan are, I don't think it's exaggerating to say this, that most of the people there are these priests' sons who have to be there to get their license. So the, and whether that mixes with whether while they're there, aspiration for the way starts to arise, and they're like, wow, I never really sat zazen before, and this much, and in a community like this, how beautiful. And so some of them, I think, do feel like, wow, this is really moving. I'm glad I got to experience for this little bit. And then they go start their funeral business. And some stay on, and some maybe feel like, well, we do have to support ourselves. Let's do the funeral business, but let's treat that as aspiration for the way. But things in modern Japan are very different from the Buddha's time, of course, and even maybe like modern China. I think just because it's become a hereditary thing and a funeral business, it's quite different in Japan. Now, of course, there's always authentic practitioners who aren't trying to do it as a business. I may be the only one here right now who's employed as a Zen priest, as my I'm financially supported to be a Zen priest. So I have to be particularly careful. You other priests are lucky. Like, am I
paying the big bucks?
To be careful? I have to be careful that this doesn't become like a job for me, right? Santa Cruz Zen Center, a very comfortable place to live and practice. I'm really supported. I have a lot of free time to practice the way I like. You know, I just have to, you know, make sure I do enough Facebook posts for the Zen Center. And, you know, keep enough events going and stuff. I really have to. So I like having sesshins because for me, these are where I can get in touch with my deepest intention most fully. Really sit and like stop all this busyness and just skip the Facebook post for this week and just sit here and like as we say in our sesshin guidelines discover anew, clarify, and actualize our deepest intention. Sesshin is so great for this. It's hard to do in the busyness of daily life. Whatever we're doing, however we're practicing, keep checking our aspiration for the way. So Thomas clearly goes on. But honor and gain does not just refer to the public or professional sphere. There are those who enter the Buddhist orders to fulfill frustrated ambitions of personal importance. Those who wish to be part of a mutual reassurance society. He's really pushing it here. A group of people who congratulate themselves daily, so to speak, for having become members of an elite. Be careful with the, especially the priests, right? Here, the order has an economic, social, and psychological function, providing a degree of stability in these realms, but it thereby becomes sterile in terms of transcendent Zen potential, because there is still fixation on worldly selves. Now, this is, he's really hitting hard here, but I think it may be a mix. It may be like, you know, I think for myself, when I remember a conversation with my teacher around Jukai, receiving the precepts, and feeling like I would like to do this, but I can I feel like there's some self behind this. Like I'd like to do it for myself. I think I'd like to wear rakusu and be express myself as a Buddhist in this way, and there's some self, I could feel the self behind it, and I thought, I said, then maybe I shouldn't do it. And he said, that's normal. It would be pretty strange if you didn't have any sense of self around these things. So, and if you're waiting till there's no sense of self to do this, you'll never do it. And I know people who have actually been that way. I feel like my motivation's not totally pure, so I'm not going to receive the precepts or do any practice at all, maybe, or, you know, because everything is tainted, so it's not even practice at all, because there's gaining idea in everything. So my teachers are like, no, just go ahead, ignore, that's really great that you see that. It's mixed. There's probably, if it's completely just for yourself and some gaining idea, then maybe not necessary. But if it's like probably most people, it's mixed. It's like, no, there really is this sincere aspiration, and because we're human beings, the self gets in there. If it's mixed, go ahead and do it. And then just keep studying and confessing and repenting. The self, the gain, fame, and profit issues around any practice, and continue and let them go. I thought, I still agree with that. Otherwise, we can't do anything. Right? In the absence of true teachers, it's easy for people to mistake relief from material and mental pressures for a sign of spiritual progress. So maybe that would be just like finding a little bit of peace through the practice. Relief from material and mental pressures. This is one reason such people do not like a real teacher, which Dogen calls the true dragon, because a real teaching situation does not allow any subterfuge on the part of the student. People with ulterior motives do not want them exposed. If they're used to hiding from themselves, they do not even want to be reminded of ulterior motives. What's really going on here? This is not on there. This is a footnote commentary by the translator, who also, you know, this is like his longest footnote in the book. And, you know, he, Thomas Cleary, spent time at San Francisco Zen Center. He was, very kindly translated the Book of Serenity, this collection of koans, while he was living at, I think, Green Gulch Farm, under the sponsorship of the abbot, Zenpatsu Baker at that time. And gave classes at Zen Center, and at some point I've heard that there was some, he got discouraged with Zen Center, actually. He felt like people weren't cutting through deeply enough, and there was, and the social, the institutional aspects, it became too big a place and became too institutional and lost its spirit, he felt, for this genuine aspiration. So now he doesn't communicate with the Zen Center anymore. Maybe there's some people who are in touch with him. But I thought that was so sad. I really appreciate his translations. But in a way, I appreciate that spirit, right, of him being so true to himself. He's like, I don't know what he went on to do. He seems like kind of like an underground guy these days. But he churns out translations by the hundreds in like 10 different languages. I mean, he's like a genius, actually. I think I could see him as a incarnation of one of these great bodhisattvas. I mean, he did like this, you know, this flower ornament sutra that's like 2,000 pages and amongst literally like hundreds of books, I think. Yeah, Arabic. Yeah, he's translated parts of the Quran.
Yeah, I wonder if he's stored Buddhist stuff in Arabic also.
He might. Yeah. He might. Yeah, he's really like branching out all different religions, finding the heart of all different religions. I'm not sure about Christian, maybe even. I'm not sure.
I mean, let's work on that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff in the Greek Orthodox stuff, but
yeah, he translated like Plato and Aristotle, like the Greek philosophers. I mean, he's quite a character.
What's his name?
Thomas Cleary. I think I've tried, you know, Googling around to try to find out more about like what he's doing. I think he lives in the Bay Area, and there was something where he there was one interview with him where he you know, he's so, I think he's like almost maybe like a hermit living in the city. Like he doesn't, he, no one knows where he is. He doesn't have any websites or anything. And, but this interview, he's like, I thought I, last week I joined like a, construction crew just for a week to see what it'd be like and to like practice in that realm, even though I don't really know how to do it. I just did some like labor carrying bricks or something with them. And that was fun. So I remembered that and I thought, this guy is some kind of character. Some kind of bodhisattva who's willing to go like into like all these unfamiliar territories. A classical Zen proverb says, if the medicine doesn't make you dizzy, it isn't potent. It's precisely because truth can only be met with sincerity that Zen teachers have traditionally imposed severe tests and refused to reassure the uncertain or to try to teach all comers. Now, there's different styles. I think truth can only be met with sincerity is what the rest of this fascicle is going to be about. My understanding of Suzuki Roshi, our lineage founder, is that he was very kind, compassionate, open to everyone, and was not outwardly very strict all the time, mostly known through his kindness. We have a few stories that he got up and started hitting people, but not many. We only finished 2 pages. So we can't really rely on teachers to be strict with us. I mean, it's kind of a big issue whether we are... Like, I'm the type of person who... I feel like just my karmic tendencies, the shape of my alaya from past lives is such that I feel like I'm always feeling lazy, like I have to, especially in my earlier days of practice, have to, I need to shake something up, I need to do something, my habits are, I just keep falling back into my habits. And so I would ask my teacher, please be strict with me. Please train me however you need to. And I think because, and I repeatedly would ask that, and I think because of that, he was very sweet to me. So kind and gentle. Other people who were like, you know, just please be nice to me, he would sometimes get pretty strict with. So, because that was my attachment, right? Mm-hmm. That was my training. I at some point I came to start seeing it that way, that like I kept wanting like him to like hit me or something, and or you know, push me in some way. But it was like, it was just my own designs. Yeah, let's do that Zen thing, like come on, push me, and then I'll be able to tell stories later at Santa Cruz about those times when he like shoved me off the balcony and I fell in the mud. But I don't have any. Sometimes he would the times when I think of him being very firm and strict were times when I really didn't want him to. So interesting, isn't it? Like, I'm just gonna do like this over here, okay? Like this right now, okay? No problem. You approve of basically everything I do, right? So I'm gonna go, What are you doing? You are not going to do that. So, that's how it goes. So be careful what you ask for, right? We often, what we think we need is often, it's the exact opposite of what we really need from the point of view of the self.
There's a book on, I guess it's in the Tibetan tradition, it's called Scary Friends. It's about spiritual teaching.
Oh yeah, or Dangerous Friend.
Yeah.
Dangerous Friend, yeah. If people ask me to be strict, I don't know how I would respond. I tend to be like, I like to be kind with others and more strict with myself. I guess I feel like I wouldn't want to be strict with others in a way that I'm not being strict with myself. Maybe that's the problem. Right? And it's like, if I'm feeling lazy, then like I can't push people to do something that I'm not doing. So, yes.
I know you touched your stick, and that usually means not to do this.
Go ahead.
I'm testing the boundary here. I just want to say something personally. You know, the way I experience your, maybe what you're calling strictness, it's like a zeal for practice. And, you know, if I try to compare myself, I would be self-deprecating because, you know, you have a level of just energy and commitment and steadiness, you know? And in a way, for me, the kind of person I am, that's more inspiring than if you were beating up on me for what I'm not doing, you know? Because it's like this constant invitation to show up that you're just modeling. And it's interesting for me to hear that you think of yourself as lazy. And that, you know, because I just have such a different impression. So it's just kind of curious to me that, you know, maybe some of that zeal is like you're trying to run from yourself in a way. But I also think it's just this authentic, you know, it's like you're, for whatever reason, that's just part of your dharma, you know. And I think there is something to just doing it and just letting example be... if there is a strictness, it would just, it's like a kind strictness because it's just, you're just doing it, you know what I mean, rather than imploring others that they should be doing it. I don't know, I just give you that feedback.
We can, maybe we can talk about in a future talk these different styles of teacher-student relationships. Like there's a whole, there's many, there's no fixed way, and one style would be like, just like a spiritual friend doing their own emphasizing their own practice, and just practicing together, and as opposed to like, I'm like, I'm done with my practice and I'm just like here to help you now. I think that's a kind of a dangerous place to be. Although maybe some people can do that. So practicing together and learning from each other as like kind of companions on the path. It looks like in the very earliest Buddhist Sangha, that's how it was. This kind of hierarchical teaching. There was always seniority in the Sangha kind of thing, but people just practicing together. They didn't set up teachers and the teacher-student relationship so strongly. And then as it... particularly in the Mahayana, that really evolved to the, you know, Tibetan tradition of guru yoga is like maybe the full culmination of that, where it's really like guru devotion is like the entrance to awakening, like the main entrance in a lot of Tibetan traditions. And everything in between. Zen, I think, is kind of traditionally in between those two poles. So we can sit a little bit, walk a little bit, and sit a little bit before a little bit of lunch. May all beings be free from the desire for fame and profit and enter the moment with sincerity, expecting nothing. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.